Cuomo News Radio, everything you need to know. Now, Newsline with Ken Schramm.
So as I mentioned a moment ago, welcome back to Newsline PM on this Thursday afternoon. Appreciate your being here. I don't think it was the relatives of the victims that were shot in Colorado that kind of kicked this into gear, but they have certainly provided a degree of momentum to the concept. A couple of families that were being interviewed by Anderson Cooper on CNN specifically asked that news outlets begin to back off of using the shooter's name from the Colorado movie theater massacre that took place last Friday. And I know there's activity around surrounding this on Facebook. Jeremy, like I said, Jeremy and I were talking about this because I stopped using the name of the guy who was involved in the Cafe Racer shooting. And I haven't used the Colorado suspect's name in the past several times that we've delved back into, episodic things that he's involved with back in Colorado. Now he's claiming, by the way, that he has amnesia. Says he doesn't remember anything. Of course, he didn't remember asking the jailers yesterday how the movie ended. So I think it's convenient. There's some real weird things happening with this guy. At any rate, this is a significant. This question comes up periodically for the media because, there's a certain level of necessity that comes with reporting a story. And when you're doing the story, if part of the big part of the story is somebody who is charged with having committed significant, horrific, unimaginable violence, and such as the case in Colorado, it's difficult to completely stay away from using the guy's name. But the principle behind this, in fact, I mentioned this at one point, that we seem to remember the Ted Bundys of the world, the Klebolds of the world, more than we do the victims. And there's certainly a tragedy to that. Mai Fernandez is the executive director of the National Center for Victims of Crime, joins me here on Newsline PM this afternoon. Hi, Mai.
It's good to be on.
I appreciate your being here. How important an issue is this to people who have been victims of this type of horrific crime?
I think it's very important. Like you said, the real tragedy here are the victims that were killed, the ones that were injured, and those are the folks that we don't want to forget. We want to highlight their heroism. There are people who are real heroes in this story that in that movie theater risked their lives to help others. And those are the stories and the names that we should be highlighting if that's what those people want, if with their permission, of course. And by highlighting, the perpetrator's name here, all we're doing is calling more attention to him, and that's probably one of the reasons he actually did this.
I think you may be right. I think that the kind of infamy he is looking for may have been one of the major motivating factors behind what he's accused of doing. But in terms of reporting the story, you see the difficulty in working around it. And I think that people are, I don't want to say gratuitously curious about the man, but I think the more we learn about him and his actions and his background and, what may have motivated him, you dig for that kind of information, hoping that, maybe you learn something that stops somebody else from doing something similar.
I think it's a question of balance and a question of focus. You're in the news business, and you've got to report the real information that's out there, and that is the name and some of the background on this guy. But if that's all that's focused on, we make this guy into something that's super special and super great. And what we do is we forget what he's done, which is he's killed people, he's injured people, he's set family on top of family into, a downward spiral. And so what we need to be doing is not glorifying him in any way. You have to report the news. His name is part of the news, but it doesn't mean that you need to mention him over and over again, that every excruciating detail of his life needs to be put out there. It's a question of trying to balance the stories that get out on the news so that we hear about some of the victim stories, that we don't forget that there's real tragedies that happened here.
Well, the other side to this, and I totally understand and agree with philosophically what you say, but from a pragmatic point of view, from a professional standpoint, self-censorship is a very slippery slope, and to ask the media to begin, showing, an additional degree of sensitivity and leave things out of a story simply because you're giving some level of glorification to someone who's committed a horrible crime or something, then you find yourself not reporting information that the public deserves to have. You see what I'm saying? It's a really delicate balance.
I do. I hear what you're saying, but in some ways I disagree. I think the media self-centers all the time or chooses to self-center. Oftentimes, victims don't want their names disclosed. It's the option for the media to disclose that information or not. Most media outlets now don't disclose the names of victims, particularly when they've asked for confidentiality. That is sort of a self-policing that happens, and it can happen by saying we're not going to make the perpetrator out to be this incredible person or get so much detail out there that he becomes a household name.
No, and you make a good point, and in fact, I'll add to it illustratively. The media has long ago decided not to divulge the names of victims of sexual assault unless those victims specifically want to go public with their name for whatever other purpose they may have by having that happen. So I see where you're coming from, and I'm not trying to argue with you. I'm just trying to, I think, turn this in a light so that we see the different facets. And I think it's unnecessary oftentimes to keep repeating the name and to even, there was someone who I can't remember who I was talking to, where you make it appear as if, well, this is a record that needs to be broken when you're reporting on the type of crime that was committed. You know what I mean?
Well, and there's lots of information about the case that can be reported on, and that's what the media should be focused on. Is there new evidence? Is there an interesting proceeding that's going on in the case? Who are the other parties involved in the case? I mean, there's lots of parts of this that can be brought out. Also, on the flip side, you can also say, what are the victims' needs right now? How can the media help those by illustrating things that are being done for the victims, like providing them counseling or support in some situations where people were displaced out of their house, where they could find support, housing support? There's all sorts of things that the media can choose to focus on. The perpetrator's name and his background is one slice of the story.
I agree. It's going to be interesting to see how the media as a whole responds to this. Because, just from an anecdotal point of view, it appears as if, his name is not being used with the same level of frequency, even when things are put forward. It's interesting, by the way, that I think the electronic media, TV and radio, have been singled out. I don't know why that's less of an impact when the name appears in the newspaper or in magazine articles. So, but I want to say thank you, Mike Fernandez, the Executive Director, National Center for Victims of Crime. I very, very much appreciate your insight on this. Thanks.
It was good to be on. Take
All right.
care.
Good talking with you. And like I say, it's going to be interesting to see what happens from here. In a moment, the debate over guns and violence coming out of the Colorado shooting. Talk about that in a moment.
Reporting the news, understanding the news. Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
It's been, tomorrow it will be a week since the Colorado movie theater massacre shootings. And almost immediately following everything, I know that Mitt Romney and President Barack Obama were both asked very specific questions about, gun laws and gun ownership and accessibility of assault-style rifles and things of that nature. I think Mitt Romney, I think it's shaping up. Mitt Romney, pretends he didn't hear the question or does not answer the question directly, and he winds up just kind of evading it. And I think the president has his whole tact has been, to provide some direct answer, but nothing specific. He talks about, toughening up background checks. I don't know how you toughen up background checks to keep the guns out of hands of criminals and the mentally ill. I mean, you have to know that they're mentally ill. You have to deal with the mentally ill. And if they're criminal, the background check is going to show that they're criminal, and they're not going to be entitled to purchase the weapon. So how do you toughen that up? Dave Leventhal is with Politico, joins me here this afternoon on this issue. How are you, David?
I'm doing well. Good to be with you.
I'm glad you're here. Thank you very much. So what if, I mean, what is it? Was it Brian Williams was asking Mitt Romney specifically? He asked him a question about the type of weapons that the suspected shooter had in Colorado. And Romney went off on something about bombs and grenades and just never even directly answered the question that was put to him.
And it's not a question that he really wants to address. He's very clear on his positions when it comes to gun laws, when it comes to gun rights. He said time and again he's a supporter of the Second Amendment and that people who are using guns for violent acts, it's the person's fault, not the gun's fault. So that's a very popular response from people who support gun rights in their entirety. Of course, that is rankling the gun lobby, the anti-gun lobby, which of course says, well, that's all the more reason attitudes like that. For Democrats and for people who support rolling back gun rights to get aggressive on this issue. But up until this point, you've seen very little in terms of some sort of legislative remedy to the situation that and the tragedy that occurred last week. And you pretty much going forward can expect one thing and one thing only, which is inaction legislatively in Congress on this issue.
Well, I cannot anticipate the president spending a whole lot of his political capital on this issue because it's a dead end politically.
It is, and he's effectively said as much, saying that Congress is deadlocked and we are not going to be able to do anything that's going to be of substance during this congressional session. Now, you can like that or you can hate that, but the reality of the matter is that it's probably more likely that an asteroid's going to hit planet Earth than anything to happen in Congress that's going to be of a substantial nature as it relates to gun laws. Now, of course, if Congress was to change hands, if there was going to be a change in the political complexion of the Senate in the House or both next session, then we might be having a different discussion. But at least between now and November, that discussion is really going to not go forward.
But I would enjoy seeing, and I think it's important to continue pressing the issue. I would like to hear Mitt Romney and President Barack Obama answer the specific question, because people are saying, well, what can we do? What can we do? Well, there's a lot of people who are saying, well, how about looking at the assault rifle ban that lapsed, that sunsetted? Why don't we resurrect that and look at that again, particularly since this AR-15 and the 100-round magazine was intrinsic to what took place in Colorado last week? And get them on position then to have to directly answer that particular question.
And if you go back a generation, you will find actions taken just like that. The Brady Bill, the assault weapons ban, things that really were sort of born on a tragedy, if you will. Things that the actions that happened as a result of major violent actions that shocked the nation. But we've written an article a couple days ago that kind of looked at the psychology of all of this as it applies to the public and how there's, in a way, sort of fatigue that comes into play where you have so many of these horrible things happen, and they oftentimes will happen every year, a couple times a year, and people no longer demand the type of very strict, harsh, decisive legislative action that that perhaps a generation ago was more expected than today.
Absolutely. David Leventhal with Politico, thank you. Appreciate your insight. Good talking with you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. I think that the politicians basically wait us out. You know, they wait out, they don't answer the questions directly, they don't provide the information that we're hoping to hear, and I think they just wait us out.
What happens next happens on the Como Afternoon News today at 3. Now, Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
You know, Seattle long ago earned the reputation of being the best place to have a heart attack. The rate of care that led to survival made Medic One an absolute national model. Well, folks here are part of an experiment to see if that can be done, but there is a hitch to that giddy-up, and I will explain what that hitch is and what it means to you in a moment.
Como News Radio, everything you need to know. Now, Newsline with Ken Schramm.
And I thank you for hooking up and hanging with me here this Thursday afternoon on Newsline PM. We were talking a moment ago about the reputation, well-deserved, having been earned by Seattle as being one of the best places in the country to have a heart attack because of the care and the rate of survival, really made Medic One, just a national model. And that we're currently in the throes of a study to see if there's even more can be done to help heart attack patients, to help the survival rate. And I fully endorse what's being done here, but I'd be less than candid with you if I didn't say there's just a little hitch in the giddy up here, because this is being done without the consent of the patient. And I even understand, you know, how do you ask a patient that's in the throes of having had a heart attack or having a heart attack, hey, is it okay if we look to see if these drugs are really working well or not? Dr. Peter Kodenchuk is a professor of medicine at the University of Washington, and he's kind of the local touch base for this. Thanks for joining me there, Doctor. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks, Ken, for having me.
Do you understand what I said in why my concern is just kind of slightly elevated in terms of injecting people with something that they're not even aware that this is an experiment?
Yeah, you know, I sure am, Ken. I mean, I'm part of the public as well, and I'm of the age and gender where a cardiac arrest could easily strike me as well. And I would be part of the trial if that were the case. Part of the challenge is realizing how big of a problem cardiac arrest actually is. It's far more common than folks realize. Cardiac arrest is when someone suddenly collapses and they lose their circulation and the heart stops beating either because it's twitching or it's stopped beating completely. It occurs about once every 2 minutes in the U.S., and if you punch out those numbers, that's about 300,000 lives per year in the U.S. that are lost. And nationwide, the likelihood of surviving a cardiac arrest out of the hospital is about 1 in 12. And sadly, that number has not changed in decades, meaning all the advances we've seen in medicine and other areas with bypass surgery and valves and grafts that have improved survival for patients with heart disease, that has not been matched across the country or, frankly, across the world with any measurable improvement in outcome for a problem that kills once every 2 minutes.
Let me ask you, I'm just curious, in the statistical, the things that you've just thrown out there, what was the prior leap? Because I would imagine, if it's now 1 in 12 and that hasn't changed in decades, you said, I would imagine that prior to the 1 in 12, it might have been like 1 in 70.
Well, you know, we don't know, because the numbers have only been tracked, and in fact, they're not reliably tracked across the country. Most communities do not even report or track their outcomes from cardiac arrest. But from recent work with the Resuscitation Outcomes Consortium, which is the sites across North America that are involved in the current trial that we'll be talking about, we've had some insight into what those numbers are now and where communities have reported those numbers in years past. We try to make those comparisons. I think suffice to say, you don't want to have a cardiac arrest, because the odds are better than 1 in 10 that you're not going to be making it out of the hospital.
You're going to kick it. So let's get to this testing that's going on. These are drugs, they're called heart rhythm drugs, correct?
Right. When a patient has a cardiac arrest due to a heart rhythm called ventricular fibrillation, and this is a rhythm where the heart is twitching so rapidly that effectively it doesn't pump at all, we provide CPR and electrical shock as the standard approaches for that rhythm. But in many cases, the shock either doesn't stop the rhythm or the rhythm continues to come back after shock, and that's the concern as to how do you treat a patient at that particular point.
So the drugs that are being administered, and so there's two different kinds of drugs, and then a saline solution, which is also assisting people when they're in this mode of having a heart attack, so it's not like they're not getting any assistance. How long will this testing be done before a determination is made as to whether the drugs are working the way they're supposed to, without any side effects, and, you know, it's a go?
Yeah. You know, I might take a step back and say that the drugs that are being used in this trial, one is called lidocaine, one is called amiodarone, and then the third is neither drug or a placebo. These drugs have been used for 10 years or more, in the case of lidocaine, for decades in cardiac arrest. But sad to say, in that period of time, there has been no proof of any kind that these drugs actually help. And in fact, there's not even agreement as to whether one or the other or neither of these drugs should be used for cardiac arrest. In some communities in the United States, if you had a cardiac arrest, for example, and you failed shock, you might be given lidocaine. In another community, if you had a cardiac arrest, you might receive amiodarone. And in some communities who don't believe these drugs work, you may receive neither one. So in this particular study, we're saying that the difference between this study and what's happening in real life out there is we're directly comparing these treatments against one another in a scientific manner that's being done without any science in the real world on the streets of the U.S.
And it's necessary to do this without consent. Obviously, as I stated before, if you're in the throes of having a heart attack and, you know, you're in the back of, one of the medic cars, it's not like you're going to be able to get a patient to sign a consent form. So I understand the involuntary nature of the testing. Are there lots of tests like this that are conducted?
There aren't, Ken, and in part it's because of how difficult these trials are to do. You could say, why in the last 20 or 30 years haven't we ever addressed this question before? I mean, we're giving drugs to folks who have a cardiac arrest without any real knowledge of their effectiveness. Why haven't we proven that they work? And the answer is because precisely why I'm on the phone now and the challenge that you're raising, how can you test these drugs in patients who can't provide consent? And what's important, I think, for the public to appreciate is this kind of trial that's being done here in Seattle, King County, and across North America falls under the greatest kind of scrutiny and regulatory oversight of any kind of trial, and it's the most challenging and difficult to perform precisely because of all the measures that are built in to protect the rights and the safety of the public. So it literally takes years to plan and orchestrate these trials because of all the regulatory bodies and ethical bodies and oversight committees that review. And even as the trials are ongoing, an independent monitoring board is looking at the results of the trial, and if they see any signals emerging in one group of patients or another that are treated that would suggest that something ought to be done differently, they can independently stop or alter the trial at the drop of a hat.
Wow. Dr. Peter Kudinchuk, a professor of medicine at the University of Washington, we've been talking about this involuntary testing. I'm glad you're here, Doc. I'm glad you're doing it, and I hope that it proves to provide us with the type of information we're looking for. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken.
You take care.
Thanks.
I want to open this up because you kind of get the heebie-jeebies. You know what I mean? I fully support what's being done here, but the question is, are you comfortable with having the possibility of being a guinea pig in the back of you're being a guinea pig in the back of Medic One? 206-421-1000 is our local line, and the toll free for you is 877-397-COMO.
You've heard what's happening. Now find out what it means to you. Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
You know, I want to make it clear that the study we've been talking about here, that the involuntary consent or the lack of consent study, we're not the focus of this. I mean, this is a national study that is being conducted, and the reason that this can be done without getting consent from a patient is that there are federal rules that allow this, at least in a limited sense, without consent. And again, you know, having talked with Dr. Kudinchuk, it's obvious that you, in the process, in the throes of having a heart attack, you can't stop everything and ask if the patient is willing to give consent to be a guinea pig. And I hate to use that term because it's more than that. I think the other thing that really helps to mitigate this is the drugs being used have been used for years. It's just whether or not those rhythm drugs are effective and whether they have any side effects, which I find amazing that they've been used all this time and there's still that much question as to what value they have. But my question to you is, you know, what do you think of this? Are you okay? Because I, like I said, I had a twinge. I had like a little hiccup that said, that gives me the heebie-jeebies that, you know, I'm without any knowledge or consent, I'm being made into an experiment here. 206-421-1000 is the local line, and the toll-free number for you is 877-397-COMO. Kathy in Burien, you're up on Newsline PM. Thanks for calling. Hello, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Thank you. I'm an RN. First of all, I'd like to point out that every trauma accident victim who comes into an emergency room, every heart attack, every patient who's not conscious is treated. We have to treat. We can't wait for consent, because if we wait for consent, people die. Obviously.
Right.
So just imagine, if you're in a car accident, you're fortunate enough to be taken to Harborview Medical Center, they're going to roll you in the door, they're going to have IVs in you, and you're going to be treated immediately without your consent. And they'll do whatever they need to do to save your life without your consent.
But here, let me ask you, Kathy, because I think there's a little bit of a difference. Yes, you're going to get treated, and you're going to be treated without your consent, but it's not as if the emergency room nurse or the emergency room doctor goes, you know, I just thought of something. How about instead of doing this, we do this, and instead of injecting this drug, we do this. It's not as if you're on a petri dish.
However, the reality is, just as the doctor said, before you get to human testing, there are years and years and years of work behind it, and, you know, here's the deal. Part of what we know about medicine is we learn about body sometimes because of the way the medicine reacts. It's not just the science. It's an art.
So as
a nurse, have given drugs that were research drugs, and I knew it. You know, it was on me to watch every single side effect, to watch every single thing that happened with that patient.
And I understand everything you're saying, Kathy, and I appreciate your call. I'm not looking at this critically. I'm not criticizing the purpose of the test or the method that is being conducted. I'm just saying I think it's important for everyone to understand that this is going on. And it's important for the idea of, you know, making sure that this type of thing is not happening with great frequency as well. It gave me a little bit of the heebie-jeebies. Christopher, in Maple Valley, you're up on Newsline PM. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for taking the call. What my concern is the placebo, the saline solution. I think I heard somebody say earlier. What I'm concerned about is what do we do when somebody's having a heart attack and they're given saline solution, and the paramedics maybe don't know that they're giving that and it's not doing anything. At that point, then they just give a second dosage of one of the other medicines, which then, you know, diversifies the data that they're trying to collect. Or they give it electric shock. And so you see where I'm going with that.
Yeah, I think they still use the paddles. They still use the CPR. And from what I understand, the saline solution has shown some positive results in the treatment of heart attack victims. But you raise a good question, and I don't know how to answer it, is if you're not getting the desired result after someone has either, A, been injected with one of the drugs or the saline, what do you do next? I think that's a very legitimate question. And to be real honest with you, I'm kind of embarrassed that I didn't ask Dr. Kudunchuk that very question. How do you gauge the effectiveness of these treatments if you're not getting the desired result? So, maybe I'll have another opportunity to do that. In a moment, how young is too young to get recruited by a college for football?
What happens next happens on the Como Afternoon News today at 3. Now, Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
Now, Marshawn Lynch, Seattle's running back, has pleaded not guilty following his arrest for the investigation of driving under the influence in Northern California. You know, this is what staggers me here. His attorney says that unless the case is dismissed, it will not go to trial until after the 2012 NFL season is over. So we're talking August, September, October, November. We're talking 5 months before a drunk driving charge can be resolved in court. Wow. That certainly would probably delay any league decision to chastise him or suspend him because of this. But we'll see what happens there. He's pled not guilty in the case. In a moment, you are not going to believe the commitment that Steve Sarkisian, the coach over at the University of Washington there, has gotten for a football prospect. Wait till you hear how old this person is.